What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 717 days since October 7th, 2023, and in that time, the Zionist State of Israel has murdered 65,382 people and wounded 166,985 others. Thousands more believed to be buried under the rubble. We know that 65,382 people is a definite undercount. We are probably looking at closer to 80,000 and climbing. 29 Palestinians have been murdered since dawn, including 25 in Gaza City, which may actually be one of the lowest numbers I have reported on one of these Mondays since Israel broke the ceasefire in air quotes, and renewed and escalated its bombardment of Gaza. At least two medical workers were wounded in Israeli shelling that destroyed the main medical center. I'm going to get into that with my guests because we keep saying destroyed the hospitals, and I at this point, I'm wondering what is left to destroy. At any rate, shelling that destroyed the main medical center in Gaza City, where mass displacement and Israeli attacks continue unabated. Joining us to discuss pertinent headlines are Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration. Good morning, Curry.
Morning, Kat.
Good to see your face. And Samer Arabi, member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, or AREC, who also co-hosts the weekly Palestine Solidarity Announcements every Friday at noon PST. Good morning, Samer.
Morning, Kat. Great to be here. And a former intern at IPS, so it's nice to come full circle.
I didn't know that. And haven't I had you guys on together before? We're just learning this. I've never had you all at the same time?
Mm-mm.
Oh, all right. Yeah, we all in for a treat because these are two very brilliant human beings. All right, well, let's just start with the medical center because that's sort of where I digressed off of my script. Israeli bombing continues. Gaza's health ministry has warned that patients are facing, quote unquote, certain death as hospitals in Gaza may have to completely shutter vital departments within a few days due to fuel shortages. Can one of you, I mean, we'll start with you, Samer, and then move on to you, Curry. Actually, I felt like this as I was preparing the script today. I feel like I keep saying the same headline over and over again, right? Like, devastated the medical system, destroyed the medical system. Departments are shuttering. And I'm not trying to make light of it. I'm really not. I'm trying to understand degrees of degradation. Samer?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And this feels like this sort of endless cycle of the same sort of horrors over and over again for the past 2 years. I'm sure folks are really familiar with that. There's a danger there, right, where it feels like we use the same discourse over and over, right? Like we were talking about the destruction of the health system in Gaza a year and a half ago when Israel was assaulting Al-Shifa Hospital. And back then it was this, you know, like giant scandal that, you know, Israel was like, oh, we would never attack hospitals. That's not actually what we're doing. And here we are. Every single hospital in Gaza at this point has been either completely destroyed or degraded. What's happening? You know, there's two things going on here simultaneously that I think are really important to understand. One is just Palestinian resilience, right? Like just because a hospital is destroyed doesn't mean that it's gone forever, right? As soon as the Israelis move on to something else, there's significant rebuilding and attempts to sort of retain some level of functionality. So, you know, get the lights back running, you know, get some rooms functioning, things like that. And at the same time, what we're seeing is a worsening degradation, right? Every time that happens, Israel hits it again and it ends up being worse. And so, you know, this is not dissimilar to, like, you know, we've been talking about starvation for, again, a year and a half, but now we're at the point where we're seeing large numbers of people dying from starvation, right? This is a thing that we had been projecting outwards. And we're seeing a similar thing with the medical system where it's clearly, you know, there's this, you know, the latest UN inquiry in the long line of, you know, like official condemnations of Israeli actions, showing that Israel is purposely targeting medical and health facilities in Gaza. And this is just the latest example of that. So like a continued undermining of the medical and health infrastructure. And the other piece of it, sorry, just to say very quickly, is, of course, fuel. A really critical piece of how the medical system works, given that there's no electricity in Gaza, everything has to be run off generators. Israel will turn on and turn off access to fuel in Gaza, specifically as this form of collective punishment. And we're, again, in a phase where they're turning off access to fuel. And so without fuel, obviously, the hospitals can't function. So we're seeing a little bit of that, too.
Sorry.
Well, first of all, I couldn't agree more with, Semra's assessment. If I could just take a little step back, just going back to what you said, Kat, about how it feels like you're saying different versions of the same kind of message, you know, each day. And I do believe this actually goes to the core of what Israel as, you know, a colonizing military power, like one of their big specialties is normalizing violence that has been considered kind of beyond the pale, you know, of what's acceptable in the bounds of, you know, an international community. And they do it anyway, and they normalize it. So, you know, to go way back when Israel first started constructing a wall across the West Bank, at first that was widely condemned, you know, not only by civil society, but by heads of state. People were like, you can't do that. You know, ambassadors, heads of state said, you can't build a wall across the West Bank. And Israel said, we're doing it. And they did it. And then they got away with it. And now they've built walls on every one of their borders in quotes, because Israel doesn't actually have officially recognized borders, but they have a fence along the border with Gaza. They have a fence with Lebanon. You know, that's what they do. And guess what? Other states followed suit. Now lots of states have border walls, and they shout out Israel when they do it. When Israel launched something called the Targeted Assassination Program, which was using helicopter gunships to kill people from the sky, you know, judge, jury, and executioner, assassinate people from the sky, that was considered outrageous and sort of beyond the pale. They kept on doing it. And then shortly after that, the U.S. followed suit with the drone program. And now it's just kind of commonplace in the world for states to do this kind of thing. So this is what Israel does, you know, and what Summer said is absolutely right. When they first attacked a hospital, they denied it. They said, we would never do that. We're the most moral army in the world. And then it became regular practice, you know, when they first started killing journalists very publicly, because now we're seeing it in real time. That's what Gaza's kind of revealing. They said, you know, they didn't talk about it, actually. And then more recently, they announced it. They said, yeah, we killed this Al Jazeera journalist, actually, you know. So this is Israel normalizing this kind of violence. And I do want to end with what Samer said, reiterate what Samer said about Palestinian resilience, because that is part of the story, too. It is the case that when these hospitals and these facilities are attacked, Palestinian personnel immediately, using whatever resources they have, get them up and running to the extent that they can. And I think that's really important, because I remember during the ceasefires that have happened, as soon as it's possible, aid does flood in and hospitals are up and running again very quickly. And that's so important that this story is not over. Actually, Gaza is not defeated. And it really matters that we stop this genocide, because there are lives to be saved and they can be saved, because actually, incredibly, Palestinians still have the capacity to sustain life.
Thank you for that, Curry. Thank you, Samer. Curry, I can't tell you how much, when you come on the show, I need for you to continue to remind us that we're going to win, that we can still win. And I think it's a critical thing that we do need to say over and over again, because those of us mired in the midst of it sometimes can lose. Not that we stop fighting, because that's just not sort of in the DNA of anybody on this call. That said, thank you for that. I'm going to digress to something I was going to get at a little bit later in our conversation, but because you brought up the ways in which Israel uses communications to normalize violence, I actually want to talk about the flotilla, the Simod flotilla, that, you know, the different excursions that we've seen, you know, lately, trying to get desperately needed aid to Gaza being attacked and escalating, increasing ways. It has left Italy, and it's now into the waters where folks are sort of guessing that an Israeli attack is possible. And there's training for scenarios, and that's not abnormal, right? There's always training for different scenarios that can happen as part of the safety. But what is different this time is that there is a training for should Israeli soldiers board the ship and attack people, right, to physically start beating them, as we know they did with Chris Smalls, who was on the last flotilla fleet that went out to sea. And there's been a decision, and I'm going to read a quote from them, and then I'll get into the Israeli spin part. But it says, quote, we have to decide collectively whether we will react or whether someone should intervene if soldiers begin to beat one of us. The question was met with silence but could not be avoided. Holding a bullhorn, the coordinator took the initiative and said, quote, if I am dragged or beaten, I don't want any of you to react or tell the soldiers to stop. Please respect my decision. And one by one, the volunteers repeated the words. For the third volunteer, the phrase had been reduced to two words, the same. So if, from their perspective, and this is very right, nonviolent strategy of the 1960s, clearly this is a direct pull out of that that playbook. This strategy was conceived to prevent further violence. So we know in 1960s, 50s, 60s South, it did not actually prevent further violence, right? Folks just got the crap beat out of them. Some people permanently disabled, some people killed, murdered, right? From being beat to death by both vigilantes and law enforcement. And this is in no way meant to disregard or disrespect people's autonomy and self-determination in terms of how they want to engage the levels of violence. Right after that, right, and so hold that for me, right, because I do want your responses to that, both the gravity, right, that this is the training that's happening, and be the very seriousness, right, of their decision. The should be right for them is their strategic decision. The Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs recently, so what, these people are preparing to have the crap kicked out of them in Israel. Israel says, you know, this is a jihadi flotilla with ties to Hamas. So, you know, whatever they get is what they get. It's basically the subtext of that, right? Knowing full well they're about to do something. We don't know what they're going to do, but we all are sort of sitting with bated breath. We know Israel is going to do something. Curry, I'll start with you.
Ooh, well, yeah, I mean, obviously, the folks on the flotilla are taking an enormous risk. I mean, we see how Israel treats Palestinians and how Israel's treated Palestinians for so long. And it has been the case as Israel violates international law in its treatment of Palestinians. It is doing so, it has done so with people who are there in solidarity with Palestinians as well. The most kind of famous example in this country being Rachel Corrie, who was crushed to death with a bulldozer, an Israeli bulldozer, when she tried to stop the demolition of a Palestinian house. But there are plenty of U.S. citizens and other internationals who go to Palestine and are shot at and wounded, seriously wounded by Israeli forces. And so the folks on the flotillas are kind of following in those footsteps. And as you say, I think following in the footsteps of nonviolent resistance movements. One thing that I will say, and I appreciate the complexity, Kat, with which you're putting on the table the use of nonviolent resistance in the 1960s, because there's a way to look at it in retrospect and just celebrate, you know, the heroism of people who did it without appreciating the risk that they took. You know, now it's kind of a place for all these officials to say, I too, you know, marched on Selma Bridge and, you know, whatever. But the fact is that people took enormous risk. And I don't want to dismiss that for a second. And I will say that that chapter of nonviolent resistance, we're talking about the Black freedom struggle in particular, is part of a story of how the centuries-long Black freedom struggle has a moral authority in this country and in the world, right? I'm not saying that it is just because of the nonviolent resistance, but when people think about the 1960s, you know, what are the images? Yeah, it's Black folks being hosed with fire hoses and attacked with dogs, unarmed Black folks, right? And one asks the question of what side are you on? Who has the moral authority here? And that moral authority is so powerful, I'm just going to make a connection, that pro-Israel forces want it. I mean, they always want the cosign from Black Americans, right? Why is that? It's because in that, the use of that strategy of nonviolence, there's something there about our resilience, you know, in resistance. And so I think that is part of what, you know, these folks in the flotilla are working to tap into to kind of have a moral high ground in the face of atrocity.
I want to say one thing before I turn it over to you, Sarah, because I think it's important for context, right? So two things. The decision that was made by the leadership of the civil rights movement of that time period, part of the reason why that decision was made, including the decision for the ways in which people were dressed, right? So when you see pictures from that time, you see people in their Sunday best. Newsflash, that is not actually how people walked around every single day, right? That's just not what was happening. There was an intention, right, to humanize as much as possible, right, Black bodies, put them in nice clothing, because that was one of the ways, right, that is one of the ways that white folks and non-black folks sort of like, well, it's not a human. And for that to be contrasted against the severity of the violence, right? That was an intentional communication strategy. And the thinking that was when people saw that, right, that would spark international outrage. So here's the layer. Hold on. And that also, bye-bye, is what gave birth to the Black Power movement. Where folks were like, hi, I live in West Oakland. Where folks were like, yeah, nah, we're not just going to lay down and get the crap kicked out of us by these white, you know, these crackers, because that's what we were calling them then. And gave rise to another set of, you know, this struggle strategy. And we're still in debate about that strategy. And I think it's really easy for people like me to be like, yeah, nah, you know, I'm not that broad. I'm not to like, you're just going to, right? And I got a little bit of history to back that up. And I've never faced that level of severity of violence, right? I never got off a bus to a bunch of white people with pipes. So I'd like to think what I would do. And anyway, Sema, the layer of the question that I actually want to shoot to you is I want to go back to rooting it in. It was an intentional decision in the hopes that, or the thinking that, the brutalization of well-dressed bodies right, would spark international outrage. We have been watching on our phone for 717 days some of the most unspeakable images of violence, I think, that any of us have ever consumed, including me, right, that watches this as part of my life's commitment to building a different world. So I guess I'm respectfully questioning strategic impact.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's fair to question, and I don't think there is a clear answer here, because as you said, the past 2 years have really brought light to the idea that, like, oh, if people just saw, you know, if people just understood the level of horror, then something would change, and that it's clearly not the case. And I would say it's even less the case now than maybe it was in like a different kind of broader socio-political order that no longer exists, right, that may have existed in the 60s on some level. At the same time, I might problematize or break down what we mean by people, you know, because I do think that those images are profoundly distressing to the overwhelming majority of people. And I do think that that is having an effect, right? It doesn't seem to touch our political class in any meaningful way, which I think really speaks to the extent that, you know, the democracy, so-called, that we live in now, like, has absolutely nothing to do with how people actually feel or think about things. But you know, the fact that the entire country of Italy was shut down for a giant general strike for Gaza tells you something, right, about how people are perceiving the things that are happening there and what it means. And so on some level, I do think that it's meaningful that it is, you know, this attempt to sort of retain the sense of like, oh, yeah, this broad sense of humanity that we're all connected to. And if people could only see that is actually true on some level. It's not true at the level of like, you know, political, you know, structural change, unfortunately, because, you know, it's not like the people with the levers of power are watching and crying and then realizing that they've been awful people. Like, that's obviously just not the way things work. But it has galvanized people and it has mobilized people in a way that I think it's important not to discount. Whether that's enough alone, you know, no, right? Like we, it's good that people hold on to things like that. And we have to understand that structures of power don't change just because of, you know, appeals to humanity, so-called. But the other thing that I wanted to touch on really quickly on this, Kat, like expanding on what Curry was saying around the sort of historical through lines of how the sort of like resistance to, you know, violence and authoritarianism has continued. Looking at the other side of it too, and the historical through lines of how, you know, like the bouncing through of, you know, what is happening in like the metropole versus the Israeli colonial outpost and how they come back around, right? And like what we're seeing is the direct consequence of the war on terror, right? And the idea that you could just call somebody a terrorist and that means that you can do literally whatever you want to them. And that's exactly what's happening to the people on the Samud Flotilla and what Israel has been doing to the people on the Samud Flotilla and obviously in Palestine and whatever for however many years is now bouncing back to what the Trump administration is doing to these boats coming up, you know, these like boats in the Caribbean where, you know, J.D. Vance and Trump are now like yucking about like, oh, I wouldn't want to be a Latin American fisherman anymore because just calling them terrorists allows them to sort of bomb these naval vessels, right, that have absolutely nothing to do with terrorist activity whatsoever. And that this like discourse spirals in on itself, right? Like, this is exactly what colonial projects are designed to do. You know, you test something here, it goes over there, it comes back here, it boomerangs around. And the fact that we're seeing it specifically with like ships in both locations right now, I think is a pretty profound a manifestation of that, you know?
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. I'm in conversation with Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Sam Arabi, member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, or AROC, having a conversation where literally, y'all, there's no other platform on the planet that I could think of that would not only let me have this conversation, but have this conversation every single Monday for almost two consecutive years. That's the work we do on this station. That's the work of this show. And that is the work that I'm asking you to support today. We are in Fund Drive. So Samer and Curry, please excuse me for a couple of minutes while I raise the money I need to raise to make sure you all can come back. A few times a year, y'all, we come to you and we ask you to give to this station, right? Not break the bank, $5, $10, whatever it is that you can give to make sure these conversations continue. I would agree with my friend Curry Peterson-Smith that it is the repeated telling of these stories that helps to continue to ignite people into action. And we are small cog in a large wheel, but we are trying to do our part, but we only do that in partnership with you. If the show matters to you, if these conversations matter to you, asking you to put some skin in the game, right? The right put skin in the game all day, every day. They support their hate. Asking to support our love, you do that by going to kpfa.org, which is the fastest, simplest, saves us some nickels way to make your pledge, kpfa.org, or by calling 1-800-439-5732. For those of you in the Bay, for those of you down south, that number is 1-818-985-5735, or you can go to kpfk.org, kpfa.org, kpfk.org, 1-800-439-5732, or 818-985-5735. And because I've spent the beginning of this show bringing you news headlines, not following traditional fundraising format, I am behind the eight ball. I have not spent a single second asking you for any money. So I'm going to call in Big Guns, the fundraising guru of this station, host of Upfront, Brian Edwards Teeker. What's happening, Brian?
First time in my life I've been called Big Guns. Kat, I have one piece of news for you, and that is that you have a fan in Oakland. Phyllis has just offered Law and Disorder its very first challenge of the fund drive. She is willing to double $1,000 if we can raise $1,000 to match her. I know time is tight for you. I know you've got live guests waiting in the wing, so I will just put it to our listeners bluntly. We got 12 phone lines coming into the building. Every single one of them is open right now. If you care about this show, if you care about these stations, if you think it is important for platforms for this type of coverage of Palestine to exist, we need you to show it with whatever you can chip in to pay the bills. Independent media is under siege in this country in a way it never has been in my lifetime. And the fact that you show your support is just as important as how much you're able to give. So the best place to donate is through the website of your radio station. In Northern and Central California, that's kpfa.org. In Southern California, it is kpfk.org. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, unless you're in Southern California, where it's 818-985-5735. $1,000 to go. Kat?
kpfa.org, if you're in Oakland, the Bay, around the world, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If you are down south, you can go to kpfk.org, 818-985-5735. If you need something besides the content of these shows, the quality of the guests that come holler at us every now and again, we are offering Genocide Bad by Sim Kern for a pledge of $110. It dismantles Zionist propaganda in 10 unapologetic essays. When I say unapologetic, I mean unapologetic. It draws connections between biblical promises and exploding pagers, medieval dress codes, and modern-day apartheid. So that's yours for a pledge of $11 a month, $100 all at once, kpfa.org, kpfk.org, 1-800-439-5732, 1-818-985-5735. I'm going to look real quick. Two callers on the line. Right on. Appreciate y'all. I know that they're probably not going to get us to 1,000. So I'm going to go back to my guests and trust the rest of y'all to handle your lawn disorder business. All right, y'all. It's exhausting sometimes. There's a UN thingy happening right now. And I did mean to say it like that. With that level of just exhaustion. So all of these, France finally has decided that Palestine has the right to be a state. The UK has finally decided that Palestinian people have a right, you know, to have something to say about what's happening on their land. And this has been met, as it has before, but it's in the headlines that more people are seeing now, that folks on the streets are saying, and what? So what? Right? We are past this conversation. This is the bare minimum of what you all should have been done. And I know this is a conversation I've had with both of you. Again, we've had this conversation sort of in this circular fashion, but we have to keep having it because they keep talking about this two-state solution. We just had a whole conversation about devastated medical infrastructure, the unabated violence. Israel does not want a two-state. Can we just say that they have no interest in that? That their solution is that every single Palestinian in Palestine is dead. That's what they want. And so, I am gonna ask the exact same question, Samer. What is the point of the performance? Because I don't believe that Macron is so stupid. I don't believe it. He's held on to power too long. Beat back extreme right wing governments have taken over his country. This is not a stupid man. And he's. So what is the point of the performance? Help, please.
Performance. I thought we solved it now. All these countries recognize Palestine. I think we're good. It's over. Congrats. It's a good question. And, you know, I wish I had a clearer answer, but I'll say that I think there's a few factors playing into this, right? One is the desire to be seen to be doing something. Right. Given that on that level, I do think it exists purely within the performative, given that, you know, the overwhelming majority of people in all of these countries, even more than here. Right. And even here, we're talking about overwhelming majorities of people. And that's remarkable, given the settler colonial history of this country. These leaders have to be seen to be doing something to respond to the genocide. And this is the easiest thing to do, right? Because it's costless, right? It doesn't actually change any sort of underlying conditions, but it allows us to be like, oh, look, Israel's mad. You know, we did a thing that like says, you know, it's some sort of tip of the hat to Palestine. And honestly, in many ways, I would say the biggest value of the recognition of the state of Palestine by all of these countries is that it's over with and they can't use it anymore. So like next time they're pushed to do something, they may have to actually do something material. So we can at least put this behind us. But at the same time, on the non-performative level, I do think that the desire here, you know, and at the end of the day, like, these European countries are balancing a few different things, but at its core, the desire is for sort of, you know, global security and the free functioning of markets, right? That's really all they care about. And the idea of a sort of neutered semi-Palestinian state that exists somewhere is a really valuable way of getting to that point, right? Where Israel continues to exist in its sort of like colonial outpost. It continues to terrorize everybody in the region into subservience. And as a result, that can be the impetus by which normalization deals are cut between Israel and all the remaining Arab countries and other places that don't recognize it. You can get these economic whatever they're called, these like roads and shipping lanes that they've been trying to build through Saudi Arabia and the UAE that go through Israel. All of that's been on hold since October 2023. And they're eager to get those running again. And I think they see the two-state solution or the Weekend at Bernie's kind of corpse held up of the two-state solution being the way in which that can happen, right? Like, no one actually cares about a viable Palestinian state. And that's never been what the two-state solution was about. We're at the point, actually, where the New Yorker, of all publications, you know, had a story last week saying that the two-state solution was always a ruse and a joke and was never actually meant as a serious thing. But like it serves the interests, right, of these countries and the sort of like underlying economic drive. And I think that's the underlying piece here. So it's valuable. I don't want to say that it's nothing. And the fact that the Israelis are so upset about it does tell us something. It's also extremely telling that, you know, you're seeing like Netanyahu's son and a few other people in Israel, like as their gotcha response have been like, OK, fine. Well, we'll just recognize like Basque separatists and like all these, you know, like you're like, yeah, great. Good. Yeah, you get it now. Like, yes, we should be recognizing people's right to self-determination. Good. But, you know, so I don't want to totally write it off. Like it's not a total nothing burger. It is largely performative, and it's a sort of attempt to, you know, in the broader European tradition of like plugging your ears and pretending we can just go back to a time before, like, you know, this world has slipped into total authoritarianism and fascism, and somehow we can keep neoliberalism alive. They still want to keep this idea of a two-state solution alive, and I think that's the underlying piece of it there.
Curry, because I'm running short on time and I want to get in as much as possible, I'm up to break in another like 90 seconds to do a quick update on where we're on fundraising. Talk about Israeli response in the West Bank. Right, the connection to, I mean, we've been watching an escalation for quite some time. That be said, there has been a recent escalation that folks are tying directly to, right, the flipping of the bird, I guess, by Netanyahu to the UK and to France and to this UN gathering.
Right. What Israel's doing in the West Bank is everything it can to make anything remotely approaching a Palestinian state physically not possible, which is really which is to say they're intensifying the settlement. They're putting more troops in the West Bank. They're doing more military operations in the West Bank. They're stealing more Palestinian land in the West Bank. And the idea is to say, you know, even if you call this a Palestinian state, it's not actually possible to run it. And this is a continuation of a longstanding policy. You know, when Israel entered into the Oslo Accords, whose stated purpose in the 90s was to move toward the possibility of someday there might be a Palestinian state, they actually put more settlers and settlements in the West Bank in that decade of the 90s than they had in all the previous decades, again, precisely to undermine the actual possibility of there being a viable Palestinian state. So this is a continuation of the Israeli policy.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. This is the Tuesday edition of Palestine Post. I was out yesterday. We're in conversation with Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Sama Arabi, member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, or AROC. Yo, we are in Fun Drive, and I'm breaking all the rules, which I am apt to do. I'm supposed to, like, play you a speech or excerpts from a thingy or, you know, interviews that I did with people about their books. But this Palestine Post has been, I'd say, the top, if not the top three priorities of this show since October 7th, 2023, from the immediacy with which U.S. mainstream media tried to justify the murdering of babies and women and elders and people through some of the most disgusting and vile methods possible, and to regurgitate Israeli talking points in the name of imperialism and capitalism and racism and all of the isms that we fight against on this show. There's literally nowhere else I can think that, I can't think of anywhere else that would let Kat Brooks have a show to run her mouth, period, but certainly not to run her mouth about things like this. And the only reason why I continue to get to run my mouth is because of y'all support. KPFA.org or KPFK.org is where I'm asking you to go to make your pledge to support this show, to support these conversations, to support this idea that I had that a scrappy lefty radio station would be a partner in movement, right? Not just reporter movement, but be a partner in movement, and to provide place and space for voices, people, conversations that don't have place and space anywhere else. Normally, around this time, I would be giving you an update about how much we've raised towards our $1,000 challenge. That is what is on the line. That is what has to be raised in the next 18 minutes. Or I got to call Phyllis in Oakland and be like, yo, I couldn't do it. I got to give you your money back. Not the way I want to start the first day of Fun Drive. Sets the tone and tenor for the rest of the Fun Drive. Okay, there we go. As of this second, with about, 6 minutes of pitching for the hour, we've raised $250 towards that $1,000 challenge. That means there's 700, y'all correct my math if I'm wrong, actress, advocate, not mathematician. I think that means we have $750 to go to raise our $1,000. That's $2,000 for your station, $2,000 that will allow conversations like these to continue. So KPFA.org, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If you're in L.A., KPFK.org, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. All right, y'all, back to our conversation. because it's you two on, and both of you not only can talk about Palestine, but you can talk about things that are happening in the rest of the world. Samer, I want to start with Syria and you. Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa is visiting New York for this UN General Assembly. Talking about hope, that's the word in the article anyway, for a security deal that will ease tensions with Israel. For folks that haven't been following this conversation, Israel's just been sort of bombing Syria at will for a hot minute now. However, he did sort of respond with, I think they used the word balk, yes, and then he balked at the idea that Syria would join the Abraham Accord. He says Syria is different. He points out that the folks that are part of the Accord are not Israel's neighbors, and Syria has been subjected to more than 1,000 Israeli raids, strikes, and incursions from the Golan Heights into Syria. Israel's never stopped bombing, right? This is another one of those asinine conversations we're having where it's the same thing. We're going to get to Lebanon in a minute, right? Israel's like, they've got to stop. They've got to get rid of the arms. They've got to stop fighting back. They've got it, right? But we're going to continue to bomb you until there's peace there. What's happening with Syria, Samer?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sharaa, not exactly one of my favorite people, but also in an extremely difficult place, right? And I think part of it is him reading the tea leaves and seeing what's happening with the other countries that signed these so-called Abraham Accords. This idea that, like, you know, I think it was a popular conception among, you know, more conservative Arab forces that, like, oh, if we can just appease Israel, if we can just get them to the point where they'll leave us alone, then maybe we can go on and, you know, with our business and rebuild our countries and whatever. And that obviously has not happened. The fact that Israel is even bombing Qatar at this point, right? Like, even people with existing U.S. security guarantees can be bombed by Israel. Like, what's the point anymore? You know, so on the sort of broader geostrategic level, I just don't think it makes sense for anyone to be like, okay, well, yeah, let's normalize with Israel. For what? Right? Like, there's no actual guarantee. And in fact, it's almost impossible to expect that Israel will stop its incursions, the land grabs, the daily attacks. Like, that's going to continue anyway. So what's the point? But on top of that, and I would say maybe as important as the kind of broader geostrategic aspect here, is that because Syria is in such a fragile state, I don't think he can afford to alienate the overwhelming majority of the Syrian people in the same way that these, like, sort of, you know, totalitarian Gulf monarchies can pull off, right? And, you know, Sharaa said in his balking, right, that, like, the Syrian people won't stand for what's happening in Gaza. Like, and they wouldn't. They absolutely wouldn't. That the idea of normalizing with an entity that is committing genocide against your, like, fellow Arabs. And, you know, these are, you know, we call it Bilad al-Sham, right? Like, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon. We all consider them, like, one kind of core subgroup of Arabs, right? So there's a ton of solidarity with Palestine and Syria. It always has been. And, you know, worth remembering that Sharaa, his, like, nom de guerre when he was, you know, with the Jabhat al-Nusra and, like, the HTS or whatever forms was Muhammad al-Julani, the Muhammad from the Golan, right? The part of Syria that Israel is occupying. So, like, there's clearly the, you know, this, like, baked-in idea that what's happening there is totally illegitimate. And, you know, obviously Sharaa is seeing the fomenting ethnic violence that Israel is actively stoking on the southern Syrian border. So who knows, right? They're desperate, I think, for financial investment and the relief of sanctions or whatever. And so the Western countries are holding that as a cudgel to force normalization. They're clearly collaborating with the Israelis already. You know, we've seen it. They used Syrian airspace to strike Iran, for example. So whether it can go further, I don't know, but, you know, it's a tricky situation, and I think it can cut a lot of different ways, despite the fact that, you know, I've never met a people more, like, anti-Zionist in their blood than the Syrian people anywhere, other than, I guess, maybe in Palestine itself. But so it would be a hard move.
Yeah, I was about to be like, whoa.
And then I was like, really? Speaking of ESNN conversations, Curry, this go to Lebanon, where there's another supposed ceasefire in place. This one based on the Lebanese government being able to disarm Hezbollah in order for Israel to stop bombing Lebanon. We've talked about before why that's an asinine conversation. The Lebanese government does not have the ability, the power, the strength, the might, the infrastructure to make Hezbollah do anything. Not that I think that anybody can make Hezbollah do anything. Hezbollah does what Hezbollah wants to do. But most recently, another tragic headline, Israel recently has bombed, again, murdering five people, three of which were children, the three children plus the father, United States citizens. We've seen, I mean, even in Palestine as well, right? We've seen American citizens be murdered by Israel and the United States not do anything. There's a piece of me, though, because I pay attention to right-wingers, right? And one of the thing that they love even more than they hate brown people is America and America first. And so there's a part of me that's like, at some point, right, somebody gonna be like, listen, they've got to stop killing our people and you not doing anything about it. And in fact, Tom Barrack, the U.S. Special Envoy to Syria and Ambassador to Turkey, just had a pretty frank conversation in which he said, and I'm using up all your answer time, that there may be, like Trump, like, backing up from his doctrine here might be on the horizon, I'm guessing, because of fractures in the party. 90 seconds, Curry, what do you think?
That Trump might be backing away from his doctrine of America first, or his
support
of Israel. Yeah. I think that one is that the question of U.S. citizenship and really American identity, and honestly, all identity in the minds of these folks, it's all contingent. I mean, it's American. It's like you're an American on the condition that you behave in this certain way, that you look like this, that you live in this place, right? And then if you don't fit in with that, then there's no, you have no kind of protections. We see that there's plenty of Palestinians who are U.S. citizens who have been abused, who've been detained, who've been killed by Israeli forces. And we obviously see it in this country, the way in our own communities, that are the notion of being an American or America first. It doesn't matter much if you are, you're American until you live in one of these cities that has been declared ripe for a deployment of U.S. troops. Actually, interestingly, which is what they reserve for people elsewhere in the world, precisely, right? So, I think that kind of contradiction of America first for some Americans and no rights for others, we see that contradiction, but I think that actually fits nicely, not only in the kind of MAGA ideology, but the whole, it goes pretty core from the start of this thing called the United States. Citizenship has always been contingent. And as with so many things, Trump is revealing it in his crude, thuggish, cartoonish way.
All right, y'all. I got 9 minutes to raise the dollars to be able to continue to have these conversations and bring your brilliance back. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate you deeply. Talk to you soon, yeah?
Appreciate you, too. Thanks for bringing us together, Kat. This is about to be my best friend now.
I'm about to do this more often. Y'all just wait. You're my dynamic duo. All right, y'all. We've been talking to Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire borders and migration, as well as Samer Arabi, member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, or AROC, who also co-hosts the weekly Palestine Solidarity Announcements every Friday at noon, which we will link to in the archives of the show. Y'all can log off. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.